From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you think back to the holidays in years past, to the gifts you received this time of the year, what were the things that meant the most? The ones you kept or shared, or the ones you keep coming back to or have with you all the time in your house? It's a book, isn't it? Often it is, anyway. A story that you couldn't get out of your head, or an insight that changed your mind. Maybe it was something that transported you or moved you or comforted you. Well, our guests today know the feeling. They're local booksellers, and they're going to join us, as they do every year around this time, with stacks of books and lots of book ideas for your list. So join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A little earlier this morning, I was looking over the book lists from our guests today, trying to see if there was a theme in there, you know, something that tied them all together, or some of them together. I couldn't really find one, to be honest with you. I never really can. And this is actually what is so great about books and so great about our guests. Good books are all over the place thematically, of course, and so are the tastes of our guests. So I think, as usual, you're going to find something for everyone today. This is one of my favorite shows, and it's a show for those of you looking for book ideas for your Christmas and holiday list. And that's all I want to say. So we're going to just jump in and let me introduce our guests, our regulars. Catherine Weller is with us, new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. It's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Kat, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
Ken Sanders with us again, owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books. It's in downtown Salt Lake City on 2nd East. Welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
And Betsy Burton back with us, as always. She co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. And Betsy, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
So I was looking for a theme. Is there a theme in books this year at all? Is there or a trend or something you're finding this time of year?
There are certainly a lot of books on politics, but I don't feel like there's certainly not a theme in fiction. Fiction is all over the place.
It's always all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of rising examinations in social justice and the environment, which is nice in nonfiction, including history, which is lovely. But yeah, it's all over the place, and it's an interesting year. It's an interesting holiday season.
What do you mean?
There are a lot of really good books, but it's overall, I can't say it's a hugely strong season. There are some very strong players, but it's not a profoundly strong across-the-board season.
And I think that's true in fiction and nonfiction.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's always some real great things, but not a ton of them, maybe?
Not a ton.
Yeah. Ken, what are you noticing?
Resistance, Doug.
I was going to say, I noticed that is one thing I saw in your list, is just you put the heading resist. Well, that's
okay. Now more than ever, resistance on every front, from, as Kat said, social justice, the environment, the misogyny that goes on in this world, and the whole Me Too movement and everything else, the audacity of a sitting president to come to our land and take it away from us under the guise of giving it to us. It's making people angry, and they're figuring out ways to, on a very local level, I think, and collectively, to give voice to doing the right thing and overpowering the money and the greed that has taken over this country. And I'll quit ceremonizing.
Okay. But you know what's nice about a book, though, in those terms, is just you mentioned, I mean, this is a time of reckoning socially. Obviously, we've heard a lot about that. What's nice about books is they help put it in perspective. Like, they give you an historical context or a new kind of insight or just a beautiful literary way of thinking about it all.
And or hope and inspiration.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. We're past the anger. We have to work on the ground, and we have to get inspiration from our real leaders. And many times those are our writers and our poets.
Yeah. And just to add a note of inspiration, independent bookstores are having a total renaissance across the country. And that's in the face of all the chains and now Amazon. So that is, you know, if you do a grassroots kind of resistance, you can succeed.
Yeah. There's a depth. Yeah. There's a depth that one has in books that is what we're talking about here, books, and I could say book selling. It is something that there's a gravitas that comes with the time that it takes to write a book, the time that it takes to read and to process a book. And that is what we need in these kinds of discussions at this time.
Yeah. Not tweets.
Okay, Kat, let's stay with Kat. You go first.
All right, depth. I'm going to start with Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, mm-hmm. We Were 8 Years in Power. And this book caused several dark nights of the soul for me. Mm-hmm. His first book did not, Between the World and Me, but this one did. And its title comes from not Obama's administration, but a speech by Thomas Miller back at the end of Reconstruction when he was trying to convince the white power structure in South Carolina that African Americans could form a good and just and efficacious government. And of course, that failed and power was taken away from the blacks. This book is a set of 8 chapters containing 2 paired essays. For each year of the Obama administration, in which Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about race in America. There is an essay that he wrote at the time, and then there is an essay that he wrote for modernity, sort of providing a context for that essay now. And it is difficult reading. A lot of this stuff I knew and needed to reckon with again. Some of it I didn't know. It is important. This is the conversation that we keep having to have because we as Americans cannot deal with race and will not deal with race. He, as it's no surprise, believes that this administration we have now is the result of a racist backlash against the Obama administration. Part of that this book is leading up to and making that argument, but it is deeper than that as well. I talked about depth, and that is what is in this book. It is everything from economic racism, the need for restitution economically. Yeah. It is the need for social justice. It's a lot of things. There's a lot in this book. Even if you've read his books or his essays in the Atlantic Monthly, there's more here, and this book is worth reading.
Say the title.
We Were 8 Years in Power, Ta-Nehisi Coates. The next one is The Republic for Which It Stands by Richard White. This is part of the Oxford History of the United States series. And Richard White is one of the great contemporary historians right now. He writes a bracing, powerful history. And this is about the Gilded Age. It is
oh my gosh, how big is that sucker?
I like a big book.
Not more than 600-700 pages.
You know, the Gilded Age takes its name from a Twain satire, but it is more than just rapacious, greedy, shallow-minded ruling elites. There was a lot that was happening in the Gilded Age. And White actually takes it to the end of Reconstruction, or the beginning of Reconstruction, actually, up until 1896.
There's a theme.
It's a big theme. It's a really broad, sweeping, vigorous history of a period of time that's often ignored. It is a terrific book. This is the big, meaty history for time. Right now, Republic for Which It Stands, Richard White. You want to talk about disruption in America? You can see it all happened once before. So a lot of this will sound familiar. Next is American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West by Nate Blakeslee. Margaret Atwood famously said in The Blind Assassin, all stories are about wolves, all worth repeating, that is. And this is a great book about wolves, pivoting, made possible by wolf spotting. The great, one of these things that comes up with environmentalism now in Yellowstone, it follows the alpha female of a pack. Her name is 06, a wolf hunter, Steve Turnbull, and a National Park Service guy named Rick McIntyre. It is absolutely fascinating as we watch the formation of 06's pack, the packs as they travel through Yellowstone, the politics of elk hunting and the competition between elk hunters and wolves. It's really a very interesting treatment of wolves.
This is on our list, by the way. Does it get at that inexplicable, I can't understand it, the human fear of wolves and the intense hatred of wolves in the
West?
Yes,
very much. Yeah. And the huge cultural clash that has happened over time, it is still happening today about the wolf in America. This is a terrific book about the West in encapsulation. Yeah. American Wolf, Nate Blakeslee.
Great. Kat, thanks. Ken Sanders.
Let's turn local for a minute, Doug.
Okay.
First up from the University of Paris, we have a local author, although he spent a good portion of his life living in Paris, Chris Ames, and he's come out with a new memoir, maybe, I don't know, An American Homeless in Paris. We've got him at the store on the 12th of December, so we'll find out more about it then. But basically, he, after a lifetime with a marriage and a family in Paris, he became divorced, and after a road trip away, he returned to Paris and sort of accidentally, deliberately decided to become homeless. And he found an abandoned golf course and set a tent up on the golf course and lived there for over a year while he commuted into the city and taught English to make a living. A very curious memoir, and I have to admit I haven't read it yet, but I'll have it read before Chris comes to our store.
Say the name again.
It's called An American Homeless. I'm pronouncing the quotation or the parentheses in Paris. Next up is Rasul Shams has been in Salt Lake City for many, many years now and founded the Rumi Poetry Society, and they meet monthly, and he is like certainly by now the definitive translator of the Sufi mystic 12th century poet Rumi. And this is a brand new translation of his poems. And I think there's not many poets, maybe Omar Khayyam and Rumi, that have lasted for almost 1,000 years now. I think a very important work. And this book, Memories Last Breath by Birgitta Sanders, I really don't want to say anything about it all except to acknowledge that it's out in book form. And you, of course, have been documenting this through the Brilliant Film Series in person. And I'm just so glad. I mean, film is one medium, as you well know, and books are a whole nother. So yeah. I'm so glad to see her astonishing story of descending into her own mental illness, yet being able to tell it to us, and thanks to you guys to share it with us all. Memories Last Breath by Gerda Saunders.
Yeah. I'll just point out,
please,
make a plug for the latest version of it. Kelsey Moore, our filmmaker, has done a beautiful job with a conversation we had with her husband, Peter, because as this story is now turning to Peter,
sure,
as he's watching all of this, and it's kind of lovely and always kind of sad too, but both of those things. All right. Ken, thanks.
One more.
Nope. Go for it.
Our own historian Hikmet Sidney Lowe has come out with the definitive book on the Spiral Jetty, the Spiral Jetty Encyclopedia. It's great. It's got vintage photographs of Smithson's and Robert Smithson and his wife Nancy Holt here down in Moab, arches all over the place back in the 70s and the 80s when this was becoming a reality. And the one thing I want to say about what I guess a category would be earth art is, what Smithson has done is real. And Earth Art, I think, is very controversial. And most of it, I think, is desecration of the land by egotists from faraway places that don't understand wild and open space Western lands. Take the madman Christo, for example, or the crazed Swede Carl Moman that gave us a piece of crap concrete tree out in the middle of our beautiful desert. This is real Earth Art, okay?
Yeah. What's the name of that again?
Just The Spiral Jetty Encyclopedia, yeah, by Hikmet Low.
We have a damn good film about that too, by the way, on Radio West Film.
You got a film about everything these days, Doug.
Okay. Thanks for the plug. Okay, Betsy.
Okay, I'm going to talk about my favorite novel of the year. It's called Sing Unburied Sing. It's by Jesmyn Ward. Jesmyn Ward, I met at a lunch, and this is her second National Book Award, and she's young. She's gorgeous. She can't be more than 30, and she knows more than any 90-year-old, and is a beautiful writer. This book takes place in Mississippi, has a kind of Faulknerian feel to it, beautiful language. But it tells a story that with powerful narrative, kind of grabs you by the throat. And the whole sort of plot revolves around a road trip. It is a young boy, Jojo, 13, his sister Kayla, age 3. And Jojo and Kayla have this just connected relationship. They adore each other. So although this book deals with dark themes, with the pain of racism, particularly in the past but in the present as well, and abuse, still, you have this wonderful relationship between the two siblings and between Jojo, this 13-year-old, and his grandfather. So there's a lot of positive and there's a lot of humanity in this book. Anyway, the road trip. Jojo, his sister, their mother, Lila, I think it's Layla, but anyway, who is abusive. And the interesting thing about the abuse in this book is that you're in her head. So you're listening to her as she's processing what she's doing and thinking of doing, which is a very odd place to be. Usually we see it from the outside. So those three people plus her sister or her friend Misty are going toward Parchman Prison, this horrible, horrible place that's been horrible and abusive and enslaved blacks long after abolition came along. And has this horrific history. Her white husband is there and just getting out, and they're picking him up. So these are the characters, along with, on the ride back, a ghost, a kid who was taken into Parchman at age 12 in a previous generation and died not peacefully. So now they're on their way back, and they stop, I think, at Misty's house, and the mother is going to bathe the two kids as this you're about to hear this scene. And she's looking at her son, who has a kind of almost a pot, and she's thinking about how when kids hit adolescent, they either string out altogether or they get this kind of pot, and he's very self-conscious about it. And they're just out of the tub, and this is when this scene begins.
Three narrators in this book, this particular passage read by the actor Rutina Wellesley.
Make sure you get in them rolls, I say. Jojo flinches like I've hit him. Shies closer to the mirror. It feels good to be mean, to speak past the baby I can't hit and let that anger touch another, the one I'm never good enough for, never mama for. Just Leone, a name wrapped around the same disappointed syllables I've heard from my mama, from Pop, even from Given my whole life. I dump Michaela, the wailing bundle, on the bed and begin toweling her off, and she's still kicking and screaming and moaning and now saying, Jojo! And I just want to give her one slap. Or maybe two. Enough to sting her good, but I don't know if I'll be able to stop. Saint Teresa, I won't be able to stop. Help me. I leave her trembling and walk to the door and yell at the bathroom at Jojo, who stands with his hands tucked in his armpits, his arms like football pads across his chest, and watches us. Get her dressed. Put her to sleep for a nap. Don't leave this room. I slam the door.
Yeah, I was listening to this reading yesterday, and some of the others that you had suggested as we were considering it. Such beautiful writing.
Beautiful. beautiful writing. This is the book of the year, certainly maybe the book of the decade. It's just an extraordinary, extraordinary book. In terms of the abuse, the getting inside her mind, you're there for a quarter of the book. It's an extraordinary experience to be there.
Say the name of the book again.
Sing, Unburied Sing, and it's Jesmyn Ward.
Okay, Betsy, thanks. Ken Sanders, let's come back to you.
A couple of literary titles. Kurt Vonnegut's dead, but they've come out with this could rival Cat's History Book there for thickness. I'm not quite sure. The complete short stories of Kurt Vonnegut. It includes six unpublished stories, and it looks like it comes in at over 900 pages. Even though most of it's published, most of it we've probably read before, going back and rereading Kurt Vonnegut is probably a better endeavor than reading most of the new stuff that's coming out. On something completely different, also dead, Charles Bukowski on cats.
That's his name.
Also dead.
It's Bukowski that's dead, not the cats, okay?
Well, so
and
more,
I did, I
so
said
more.
Cats, not cats.
I'm still here.
I just find it strange bedfellows. I, for one, never knew that Charlie Bukowski was a cat person. But there are photographs of him in here with his cats. So apparently he was a cat lover, and I never knew it, and this has been out of print forever. So
wait, what are they, like essays? Or
yeah, they're essays on cats with there's his wife with the cat. But there are photos of Charles Bukowski with cats in there. I found it quite amusing. On the Mormonism front, the most fun book that has just literally come out, it's still shipping, I don't think it's in the stores yet except for review copies, is Signature Books, who does the great, brilliant local Mormon publishing, a 3D tour of Latter-day Saint history.
Yeah, I heard about this.
It comes with a little pocket with two in case you lose one. It's 3D glasses. And here, for your viewing audience,
yeah.
Here is a 3D photograph of the famous Amelia's Palace, now torn down, home of one of Brigham Young's favorite wives, Amelia Folsom Young. It's based on an old Mormonism through the stereo scope that was a 36 view card set that came in a box with a companion guide written by the Mormon historian scholar B.H. Roberts. And it's just a delightful, fun present that I think will delight Mormons and non-Mormons alike.
Kat, this is on your list.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is any of this the work of that Williams who was he did stereoscopic work in exactly that time?
I think the photographers, I can't recall his name. It's not Williams, though.
Okay.
But it's just a delightful book.
Great. Let me just say the title, A 3D Tour of Latter-day Saint History.
And it's just a fun title. It'd be
comes
great.
Comes with the glasses,
two
too.
Pairs
two
of 3D
glasses.
Glasses.
Okay, brilliant. You can share.
On a completely different note, we have this, another big fat one, another Moby Dick of a book. This one is called Mormonism Under the Microscope by a Joel M. Allred. It's self-published. I know what we think of that. But this man has some lifelong historical and philosophical issues with the way the Mormon Church has been run, and he presents a very scholarly look at it. It's not a crackpot work. It's very scholarly, and he makes some really interesting intellectual asks a lot of intellectual questions on why is it done this way? Why are we, I won't go into the details of it, but for someone that's looking at a in-depth look at Mormonism, I'd highly recommend it.
And, one of the things that we worry about with self-published books is also just the physical quality of the book. That's actually a well-made book.
Yes.
It doesn't have poor printing quality. The binding's good. The
nope.
Paper's good.
Great.
And he even has a barcode.
Very important to booksellers.
Great. Ken, thanks.
I'm done.
Brilliant. All right. Kat, back to you.
All right. My next book is Wild Horse Country by David Phillips. This is a book about the Mustang in the West. And Mustang is one of the great symbols of the American West, like the wolf. Mm-hmm. And like the wolf, a source of great controversy over a great period of time that's gone into today, it, boy, the horse is quite an animal. And this book actually starts way, way back in prehistoric time and moves forward. But we have a passage selected that starts in 1950, spring of 1950 to be exact, with a 38-year-old secretary named Velma Braun Johnston, who's driving to work in Reno in the morning, and she's late to work. She's driving to town behind this fully loaded truck that's going really slowly. It's a big livestock truck. And as she's driving behind it, she sees that blood is dripping out of the back of the truck. And she's starting to worry about that as they're pulling into town. And so I'll let the reader take it away from there.
This is David Colace reading David Phillips' book, Wild Horse Country.
The flow of blood increased as the truck rolled down the highway. By the outskirts of Reno, it was a constant stream. The truck pulled off at the stockyards in Sparks, Nevada, and Johnston followed. When the truck parked, she went up to peer through the slats. What she saw stole her breath. The bed was packed full of Mustangs, many of them bleeding from wounds as though they had been blasted with shotguns, others bleeding from torn hooves. One stallion had both his eyes gouged out. As the horses jostled and shifted, she saw a colt on the floor, trampled to a pulp by the crowd. She asked the driver where the horses had come from and why they were in such ghastly shape. He pointed to the Virginia Mountains and said the horses had just been rounded up by a plane out there and were headed for the slaughterhouse in California. Johnston began to weep. "No use crying your eyes out over a bunch of useless Mustangs," the driver said. "They will all be dead soon anyway."
It's how they thought about Mustangs, I guess, in that time.
That's how some people thought about Mustangs at the time, and that's the nut of this book. Are Mustangs interlopers, vermin to be exterminated? Are they symbols of the West? Are they indigenous creatures who are merely reintroduced by the Spaniards who have come back?
It goes through all of that.
And uniquely adapted. Yeah. Yes, yes. He makes a pretty compelling argument looking at the fossil history in America of the evolution of the horse, and moves it forward to this woman, Velma, who became Wild Horse Annie and responsible for the Wild Horse and Burro Act that today has this curious responsibility to round up and preserve horses, but doesn't really know what to do with them after it does that. So it's an interesting book. It's well worth reading if you're a horse lover or a lover of the West. Wild Horse Country by David Phillips.
Great. Betsy Burton.
Well, I'm going to talk about three books that are very different from one another that are just marvelous gifts. And the first one is This Immeasurable Place, Blake Spaulding, Jennifer Castle, Lavinia Spaulding, photography by Ace Cavalli. Blake and Jennifer run Hill's Backbone Grill and have written before one cookbook, which not only was beautiful and had wonderful recipes, but really was about farm-to-table cooking and about community. This one is about living on the edge of wilderness. The wilderness being, of course, not Hill's Backbone Grill, that's the name of their restaurant, but the Grand Staircase National Monument. And this is an amazing cookbook. It's beautiful in terms of the photography and in terms of the picture it gives of the land around them, their farm, their recipes, which are to die for. But also, it is a love letter to the Grand Staircase National Monument. And never has there been a time when this was more important, when they're trying to cut it in half, slice it up, and take it away from us.
Amen.
And she is doing they are doing everything they can, as really are a lot of the people down there, you know, contrary to the newspaper reports, which say that this ruins the economy. The economy is actually thriving down there because of tourism, which is a big, you know, boost to tourism. Anyway, we were down there for 4 days. We ate the most wonderful food. out of this new cookbook. It is just wonderful. She and Jen are going to be at the store tonight from 5 to 7 signing, and she's going to be around town. And I just can't tell you how great a gift this is.
They'll be at our shop on December 15th as well. And one thing I'd like to add about the book is the essays they've commissioned by people
Craig
like Amy
Childs
Irvine, and Craig Childs, and a bunch of the Buddhist monks that
do a retreat
down there.
A poem by Mary Oliver.
Oh, no way.
It's just a treasure.
Wow.
There are quotes from, Ed Abbey, as you said, Terry Tempest Williams.
It's a treasure.
It's just an amazing book.
This Immeasurable Place.
Yes.
Great.
So, okay, another wonderful book that really spans all kinds of things, because Leonardo da Vinci was indeed a Renaissance man, and he was an engineer and a mathematician and a scientist, and in a resume he put his art like in paragraph 11 because he didn't think it was so important. But what's so important about this book is that it's a wonderful history and it gives you a wonderful timeline and lots of color, but also each of the things he knew about informed or made him more proficient at each other thing that he did. And really, the art benefited more than anything else from his studies of light, his studies of anatomy, all informed his art in such amazing ways. This is just a compelling read. It's gotten a lot of little quirky displeasure because in the end he talks about lessons he took from Leonardo's life. A, it's hardly part of the book, and B, I thought it was kind of interesting. Walter Isaacson, Leonardo da Vinci. A very small book, Silence in the Age of Noise, Erling Kaga, I guess you say. He is Norwegian, he's an explorer, and I was going out the door with my box of books and Jamie said, take this home and read it tonight and put it in because you need to. And I said, well, okay. And I did. And it's a wonderful book about silence. He started an essay on silence. He started a lecture, and he became very intrigued. He realized his kids weren't having that sense of wonder anymore, and they weren't wondering about things anymore. He wondered what had happened to all of us, and he decided silence was the answer. So he set out. He's already crossed both poles twice and climbed Mount Everest on foot, but he set out across the South Pole again without a battery in his cell phone to explore silence and the different shades of white and white snow and all kinds of things. There's just one riveting passage I have to tell you about. He's talking about how unaware we are, how not in the moment we are. And he has these two, there's an experiment where two people have to look at each other in the eye for 4 minutes. And what was terrifying was the act of doing that and seeing, but even more, the act of having someone see you for 4 minutes. So being in the moment is something this teaches us that we all badly, badly need to know about. And then just quickly, one more because it's big and beautiful, and this is one of those tomes.
Oh!
Annie Leibovitz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Annie Betsy, Leibovitz. Betsy wins.
But it is so extraordinary. Here is our TV commentator. And
John
think of
Stewart. Yes.
John Stewart, and think of all of them under what you see on the mic. Here he is in his skivvies.
Yeah.
And the mess under there of all the people contributing. She gets the reality of everybody's life. And one more that's just as beautiful is Emmett Gowan, Mariposas Nocturnus. This is just about the moths of Central and South America. And he doesn't pin them or capture them. He takes them in place. And it is exquisite. There's a foreword by Terry Tempest Williams. But more than anything, it really is a wonder that teaches us about the diversity of our country.
What's the name of
that? I mean, of our world.
Yeah.
It is Mariposas Nocturnus. Emmett Gowan is a photographer.
It's Betsy Burton. She is with the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th. We have with us Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. It's on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. And Catherine Weller is with us from Weller Bookworks there at Trolley Square. Okay, we have a list, by the way, I should just point out, of all of these, and the ones we won't get to, because we won't get to all of them, on our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a break. We're way late. So we'll do that and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, our annual holiday book show. Most of you know how this works. We bring into the studio our three bona fide book experts who have right in front of us stacks and stacks of books, mysteries and novels and nonfiction and poetry and picture books. We'll get to stuff for kids here in just a moment. It's Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Kat Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. And let's see, we're going to start back with you, Mr. Sanders, Ken Sanders.
Okay, Doug, thank you. I'm going to turn back because of these times we live in. I've done this a million times before. My old Kentucky friend, poet, farmer, mad farmer, radical liberation front, Wendell Berry. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. I believe that the essays, the novels, the poetry, and the other writings of Wendell Berry make him the most important living writer we have in this country today. You need to read your Wendell Berry. And having said that, I'm just going to read these short poems and I'll quit when I run out of time. Okay?
Good, okay.
The expert on resistance to torture becomes an expert torturer. The machine that helped a woman to do her work replaces her at work. The machine that helped a man to think ticks on in absence of the man. The communications technology that was to become the concourse and meeting of all the world, bringing the longed-for peace to all the world, becomes a weapon to break the world in pieces. Two. Surely there's something simple, wrong from the start, but the turning wrong is worse. Gains containing the seeds of loss, amenities fated to do harm. To warm our houses, we set the world afire. The gullible, the frivolous, the hard of heart make of modern miracles normal, terror, and perpetual war. The first robot we heard of was a bomb. Three. Will the robotic tree perform the original miracle, transforming light into life? Will the robotic leader come at last to achieve our objective? Feed the hungry, forgive the debtors, heal the sick, give sight to the blind, release the captives, raise the dead? Or do we look for another? Four. If we surely knew that the man before us, single in the multitude, would wreck the plane that would wreck the tower, whose fall would wreck a multitude of living souls, who would not kill him? If we knew for certain that one man in the cell would, if tortured, tell the truth and save a multitude, who would not torture him? Five. After the mathematic of the crucifixion, who would not destroy one to save a multitude if by the destruction of one so many reliably could be saved? But that is as numbers are, and of us who can foretell the future of numbers? One small seed lost in the multitude, dying in the ground, sends into light a mighty tree. But that is the original miracle returned once again in time. And who of us can foretell in time the future of a miracle? Wendell Berry. Read him.
Terrific. That's from A Small Porch, by the way.
Thank you, Small Porch. Yeah. Big poems from A Small Porch.
Yeah. Betsy Burton.
He is wonderful.
How do you follow that? Yeah, he is wonderful. Wow.
Well, from the sublime to the mundane, I guess. I'm going to talk about mysteries and thrillers. So I'm going to do it quickly. And the first one I'm going to talk about is a local book. It's called Abracadabra. It's by David Cranes, who taught here for many years at the university. And it takes place in Las Vegas. And the main character is Elko Wells, a private detective. And the mystery revolves around a man who disappears inside of a disappearing act. And Elko has to find him. So quickly.
David Cranes.
John le Carré, A Legacy of Spies, is a fabulous thriller written when le Carré is well into his 80s. And it involves Peter Gwillim, for those of you who know the work Tinker Tailor, and Spy Who Came In from the Cold. This is MI5 coming back to Peter Gwillim at age 70 about something that happened during Spy Who Came In from the Cold. And what happens is you're juxtaposing the old Cold War world and the world we're in now.
Wow.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Do you need to read the other two?
No.
Okay,
no.
Brilliant.
Find it all the way. John Lawton, Friends and Traitors. John Lawton has this Inspector Troy, who is in most of his books. And in this particular book, Troy was a friend of Guy Burgess. And his brother warned him against him, said, you know, stay away, he's a communist. But he was a kind of friend. And then Burgess defected. Now he wants to come home. And that's the kind of nub of this book. Displaced, a thriller, right after World War II, set there's a Jewish agent who wants to go start the new land, and instead she's sent back to post-World War II Europe. She doesn't want to go. And she ends up looking for this scientist who supposedly was killed in a concentration camp. And in the process, she travels to Great Britain. She travels to all the refugee camps. She sees very clearly the seeds of what was going to happen in the post-World War II world. So just a brilliant thriller by somebody, a new author, Stephen Abarbanel, Displaced. And then quickly, just a couple of mysteries that I'll mention. The Driver by Hart Hansen is about a returned Afghan vet who wants to help vets, and he can't figure out a way to do it, so he starts this driving company, and he hires all vets, pretty disabled vets. And they take on as a client a skateboard star who somebody is trying to kill. Wow. So an interesting mystery, a great read. And then I just want to mention, too, because you're not going to get to him, you said,
yes.
Michael Connelly is a book about that has two different plots, one to do with a case from his past that they're trying to get him about, and one to do with OxyContin. And The Newly Child is also to do with OxyContin. So between the two, you get a pervasively interesting look at the drug ring and people who use and all of that. And both are great reads by authors who sometimes write good books and sometimes don't, but these books are great.
Say the name of the books again.
I can't even remember because Kim took them from me.
Michael Connelly's Two Kinds of Truth and The Lee Child. You have the book there.
Oh, right? I still have it here.
I don't know what
I thought
did
I
did.
No, I handed it to you.
No, we've got it somewhere.
No, you didn't.
Okay,
we'll
oh, here it is. Here it is.
No, there it is. Okay.
It is. The Midnight Line.
Got it. Okay, brilliant. Snagged that one. All right, Kat, back to you.
Okay, my first one is a book that is driving critics crazy, and a lot of readers too. Louise Erdrich, who's one of our greatest novelists of our time, has written a genre fiction piece called Future Home.
This is on our list too. I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say about this.
Future Home of the Living God. Yeah. She started this in 2002, set it aside, came back to it in 2016, provoked by events. This is an epistolatory novel written by a young woman named Cedar Hawk Songmaker, an adopted child. She's Native American, adopted by nice liberal white people, who discover she's pregnant at a time when everything is going to hell. Society seems to be evolving backwards. And so she goes to reconnect with her family, her Ojibwe family. We learn about society falling apart. We learn about totalitarian government. But mostly what this book is Louise Erdrich's wonderful pacing and terrific characters. And it's not Handmaid's Tale again. It's obviously there's some of that in here, but it's a lot more, and it deserves to be read on its own right. So right. Future Home of the Living God by Louise Erdrich. I did like it.
Did you?
I really did. I enjoyed it.
Because they're mixed reviews, right?
Very mixed. Yeah, very. This next one is a romp. It is fantastic. Seventh Function of Language by Lauren Binet. If you went to college in the 80s like I did and you studied Lit Crit, you are going to love this. This supposes that the semiotician Roland Barthes was not accidentally killed by the laundry van, but was murdered because he has this discovery of a seventh function of language that will make somebody win debates and an oratorical master. And in it, one encounters things like a philosophical fight club in which the loser must surrender body parts. There's this Walpurgisnacht type riot in which Derrida, between analytical and continental philosophers, and it's Derrida who ends up being chewed up by dogs. I mean, it is just over the top, total farcical thing. It is just a delight to read, and it's got all the cast of characters from Sixu to Kristeva. Everybody's in here. It's lovely. Seventh Function of Language by Lauren Binet. Another romp, Stony Mesa Sagas by Chip Ward, beloved former assistant director of the Salt Lake City Public Library.
Yeah. Terrific writer,
terrific writer of nonfiction, and now a novelist, historical and fantasy intertwined with the Essex Serpent set in Victorian England involving natural history and a mysterious serpent.
The Essex Serpent by
Sarah Perry.
Sarah Perry. Okay, good job, guys. We have time for kids' books when we get back from a break. That's Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Ken Sanders, who owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake, is with us. And Betsy Burton, of course, from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Okay, kids' books when we get back from another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and it's time for another screening in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. On Thursday, not Wednesday, we're screening filmmaker James Redford's film about renewable energy. Redford went on this quest to learn more about renewable energy, and what he wanted to know was, do we have the capability to replace fossil fuels, and do we have the will? The film is called Happening. Join us at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center Thursday night at 7. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This is our annual holiday book show. We have with us Catherine Weller, Ken Sanders, Betsy Burton, and we're on now to the children's books round. And Ken, I guess. Yes, Ken, let's start with you.
Children's. So 20 years ago, Philip Pullman wrote a brilliant trilogy called his Dark Materials trilogy. And despite the botch they did of the Golden Compass movie, maybe to set things right, he's starting all over again with a new trilogy called The Book of Dust Trilogy. Volume one is La Belle Sauvage. Sounds like French to me.
Yeah.
And it features the heroine of the first three books, Lyra, which, by the way, although she wasn't named for it, my six-year-old granddaughter happens to be named Lyra. But they didn't know about the Pullman books when they named her. I think this is going to be a great new fantasy trilogy for older children, and adults love him as well. Shel Silverstein.
The Book of Dust.
The Book of Dust, Volume 1, La Belle Sauvage, yeah. Philip Pullman. Shel Silverstein, another dead author, has another new book out. Runny Babbitt Returns, and maybe they'll just keep doing these forever. I'm not quite sure. But I'm happy to have a new Shel Silverstein book out.
Terrific.
Lastly, I've talked about these Kala editions many times in the past. They're classic reprints. They're beautiful paper, beautifully printed, actual cloth covers. You can feel the cloth and just beautiful sewn bindings. This happens to bring the classic British illustrator Arthur Rackham together with two Christmas tales by Charles Dickens, both A Christmas Carol and The Night Before Christmas. Oh. And it has just... Arthur Rackham is the king of the golden age of illustrators and would make just a beautiful Christmas gift. That's it.
Perfect. Betsy.
Okay, I'm going to start with some picture books, and the first one has no words at all. It's called Professional Crocodile, and it's by Giovanna Zaboli and Maria Chiara de Giorgio. I'm
Good
not going to say that twice. And it's about a crocodile who gets up, brushes his teeth, gets dressed, commutes, does all the things that one does to commute in a city, and has all kinds of adventures along the way, and then gets to his place of work where he undresses, and in the very end, there he is in the zoo being a professional crocodile. It's charming. The illustrations are wonderful. Then Mother Goose lined out. Bruce is about a bear who loves eggs, and he cooks them all different ways. But one day, the eggs hatch, and he has some geese, and they bond with him, and he tries everything he can do to get rid of them. They just follow him everywhere, and he tries to teach them to fly, so they'll fly away, and finally, he and they fly away to Miami, where they go every year.
That's great. What's the name of that?
This is Mother Bear, but Goose is lined out. Ryan Higgins.
Got it.
Okay, and then one chapter book, which I had to mention. This is another one, a bookseller. Margaret grabbed me and said, you have to read this, and I read it, and I wept. And it's called Refugee. It's by Alan Gratz, and it's about three different children in three different times who are refugees. One, a refugee from Germany who's trying to get out of Europe and to America. And then one, Isabel, a Cuban girl in the 90s, and then Mohammed, a Syrian boy. And these are, I don't have time to talk much about it, but these are just incredible tales of the journeys. And then in the end, there is something that connects all three. And it is just a graphic but really wonderful picture of what refugees go through. And I think it's an important book for kids to read.
Refugee Alan Gratz.
Right.
Kat.
Okay, my first one is a book by Adam Rex called Nothing Rhymes with Orange, and this is a rollicking book. I love this spread that starts with, and you'll know why I love this book, "I think cherries are the berries, and lychee is just peachy. Thus spoke Zarathustra" is a book by Friedrich Nietzsche. rhyming peachy and Nietzsche is fantastic. And down here you can see the orange, who provides commentary throughout the book saying, "What?" And the poor orange, Nietzsche reappears on the next page saying, "Frucht!" "They're healthy and happy and cute. I don't see why he's in this poem, and I'm not." It's a very cut-up art style.
Terrific.
It's terrific and great fun. And at the end, they figure out a way to include poor Orange, who doesn't rhyme. But they make a rhyme for him. Next is a book called After the Fall, How Humpty Dumpty Got Back Up Again by Dan Santet. Poor Humpty Dumpty, of course, he has a fall. They put him together again physically, but he's got PTSD, really. And this is how Humpty Dumpty comes back from PTSD. So it's about coming back from a fall, you know, any kind of a fall. So although I do rail against having fully didactic books for children, this is a really nice, playful way to approach it. And it is fun, too. After the Fall by Dan Santet. Her Right Foot by Dave Eggers is about the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, read about this. Sean Harris does the beautiful
drawing. Yep, Sean Harris does the art, which is a lovely color. It's a lovely palette. It's very retro in style and palette. And it's about how the Statue of Liberty is moving. And it tells lots of little factoids about the symbolism, how the statue was built, the symbol of her crown, et cetera, et cetera. But also it talks about what she means and why we should be moving forward as a country. Her Right Foot by Dave Eggers with art by Sean Harris. And very quickly, last, a very great book and an important one, I think, called Not So Different by Shane Burkaw. This is a young man who lives in a wheelchair. He is a young adult. The whole point of this book is to answer questions that kids might want to ask about life in a wheelchair. He tries to anticipate those and answer them.
Okay, we're essentially out of time, but let's do a quick lightning round. Go for it.
Kate McLeod has a new violin composition, Nature Fiddle. She calls it Vio Fiddle Music, CD out, Deep in the Sound of Terra. It's absolutely brilliant. It's the best work of her career.
Wow, gosh.
Famous and Infamous, A Guide to Salt Lake City Cemetery by Linda Hilton. It's a map.
Three books of poetry, Title Only, Half Flight, Collected Poems. Frank Bedart won the National Book Award. Mary Oliver, Devotions, Wonderful Selected Poems. And The Odyssey by Homer, translated by Emily Wilson, a brilliant new translation.
That's not a bad lightning round, guys. But Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. Of course, we didn't get to everything we thought we would. We never do. But you can go online and get the full list at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Kelsey Moore, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.